From New England Public Radio in Springfield, Massachusetts, this is NEPR News Now. Stories you really should not miss. I'm Sam Hudzik, the news director at New England Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening today. Hopefully you are listening in air conditioning. Coming up, after the election of Donald Trump as president, a lot of nonprofits saw a surge in fundraising. Apparently not enough of that went to the American Friends Service Committee, which is closing shop in Western Mass.
There's just not the money in our society and culture now. And the people who have it are hanging on to it.
That group is responsible for many a war protests in Northampton, but organizers say they have a plan. Then, part two in our series about wastewater and what new EPA nitrogen regulations might mean for treatment plants along the Connecticut River, far from Long Island Sound.
The reality is that municipalities are being forced to accommodate nitrogen, and it's on our shoulders, and it's costing a lot of money.
Also on the show, we have a little Theodore Geisel. You know that guy.
That's Sam I Am. I do not like that Sam I Am.
And you can get your Dr. Seuss fix at the library, of course. Well, for now. The president's budget includes some big cuts for books. And our commentator is concerned.
I grew up in farm country back when kids roamed barefoot and free in the humid summer. Byard Taylor Library was a favorite destination. Full disclosure, the library was air-conditioned.
See, it all comes back to the air conditioning. And we wrap up with bird sounds. No. Not those birds. These birds. Woodpeckers. All that just ahead on NEPR News Now. A venerable peace and social justice group responsible for many anti-war protests in the Pioneer Valley is shutting down. The Western Massachusetts chapter of the American Friends Service Committee says it will close its doors at the end of September after nearly 50 years of activism. New England Public Radio's Kari Injiri reports.
As these things tend to, the decision to close came down to money, says Jeff Napolitano, the director of AFSC's Western Massachusetts chapter.
For about 9 months now, we've been aware that there's a bit of a financial crisis at the international headquarters, and although we knew that there were going to be cuts to the organization coming, we only found out that that was going to happen here in Western Massachusetts.
Calls to the American Friends International headquarters in Philadelphia were not returned, but Napolitano says he believes another 20 chapters are also slated to close. And despite being located in a progressive, politically active region, he says the local chapter's hands were tied.
We actually weren't allowed to try to fundraise out of the problem because that function is done at the headquarters in Philadelphia. When they have a financial problem, we have a financial problem.
There's just not the money in our society and culture now, and the people who have it are hanging on to it.
Frances Crowe founded the local chapter of American Friends in the basement of her Northampton home in 1968.
I was a volunteer for 24 years, and it really didn't cost AFSC very much except our printing and mailing. But things have changed a lot since. And I think the national office isn't able to, you know, raise the money. It takes big money now for all of these small offices to operate.
Now 98 years old and describing herself as somewhat retired, Crowe continues to participate in a weekly peace vigil in Northampton, as well as running a free film series at the local library. And both she and Napolitano are trying to make sure peace activism continues in Western Massachusetts, albeit in a different form and under a different name. Last week, a fundraising campaign was launched for a new organization called the Pioneer Valley Peace Center. Napolitano says 13% of the $75,000 goal was raised in the first 4 days.
National organizations, particularly national organizations that are older, are sort of struggling to continue the work. But I think that the solution is really to look for the support directly in the communities where people are doing the work. And so that's what we're trying to do here.
Meanwhile, Napolitano says the work of the Western Mass American Friends Service Committee will continue through the summer. For New England Public Radio, I'm Kari Injiri.
Wastewater plants in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont are waiting to hear about new nitrogen regulations from the Environmental Protection Agency. In salt water, too much nitrogen can be deadly to fish and plants. By the 1980s, it had become a big problem in Long Island Sound, and the EPA started monitoring nitrogen levels there. By 2001, the agency set new nitrogen limitations for wastewater treatment plants in New York and Connecticut that operated right on the Sound. Now, EPA is turning its attention to plants on the Sound. Largest tributary, the Connecticut River. New England Public Radio's Jill Kaufman reports.
In the fresh water of the Connecticut River, nitrogen is not a problem. So in the 1970s, when the Clean Water Act prompted the construction of wastewater plants up and down the river, they weren't built to filter out nitrogen. Now, retrofitting a plant to remove nitrogen can be an adjustment of a dial or a major rebuilding of a system. In the case of the plant that serves Springfield, Massachusetts, and six other towns, increased nitrogen removal will be a huge undertaking.
The reality is that municipalities are being forced to accommodate nitrogen, and it's on our shoulders, and it's costing a lot of money.
Josh Schimmel, executive director of New England's second largest wastewater treatment plant, wants proof that nitrogen is actually going from his plant on the banks of the Connecticut River into Long Island Sound.
You know, it's a color-coded map.
A color printout of a map of Long Island Sound is on Schimmel's desk. In the picture where the Connecticut enters the Sound, it's blue and looking pretty healthy. But near New York City, the water's all red. That's where there's a bad case of hypoxia, not enough oxygen for wildlife, prompted by nitrogen.
When you look at it, it doesn't make any sense that communities along the Connecticut River are going to be spending millions of dollars to deal with a nitrogen issue when you see that the issue really is primarily based upon the Hudson and East Rivers in the urban areas of New York City.
Looking at the map, Schimmel wonders why New York City's hypoxia problem is his to solve. He calls the EPA's nitrogen data pseudoscience. EPA officials said in an email that the agency always, quote, seeks out and uses the best and most relevant data to make regulatory decisions. But more data are needed.
What we basically have are instruments in here that are measuring the stage of the river.
The United States Geological Survey is gathering data here at a stream gauge located in the river near Windsor, Connecticut, just past the Massachusetts border. USGS hydrologist John Mullaney says to figure out how much nitrogen is in the river, you need to spend years measuring its water flow because land use continually changes, and so does climate.
One of the things that affects our nitrogen loads here for the Connecticut River, for instance, is nitrogen that comes in rainfall. It comes from emissions from coal-burning power plants, automobiles, all throughout the region.
And drought, heat, and cold all impact data. And around the tidal parts of the river, south of this point?
It's fresh water, but interestingly enough, when the tide is coming in, the river flows upstream. So in a sense, when you're trying to count that nitrogen, you don't want to count it twice because it's going to go by once and then it might go back upstream again before it goes down again.
So from what the EPA, the USGS, and others know, could nitrogen that comes all the way down from Vermont really make it into the Long Island Sound? Yes, but septic tanks, farm field runoff, the atmospheric conditions in total add up to a higher load of nitrogen than from wastewater treatment plants. And fair or not, says Beth Card, the reality is treated wastewater is measurable and easiest to control because of state and federal regulations. Card is a deputy commissioner at the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection.
You know, we also have to remember that we're asking for investment to protect a resource that a lot of folks who live in the upper watershed will never see or never enjoy.
The Connecticut River is not impaired by nitrogen, Card says. But that doesn't mean Massachusetts and other states get to ignore the problem. But Card does want to make sure the EPA is approaching any new regulations with the best information possible.
The state is stepping up in the sense that we are working very actively to make sure that all of the partners have a voice in the process.
Before things are finalized, Card says, and that means before EPA decides how much nitrogen will be allowed in treated wastewater. Those partners she mentions, they include plant managers, city leaders, and activists like Andy Fisk, the executive director of the Connecticut River Conservancy. He says wastewater plants are not off base with the concern they're doing more than their fair share.
Communities are looking at the ways they can develop so that they don't increase the amount of water going into their wastewater treatment plant, which may be at capacity, or treating things at the local site level so that it doesn't cause a problem when it runs off.
There are other solutions to this problem, like changing the way parking lots are built and establishing more oyster beds to absorb nitrogen. Fisk says it's a little late in the game for a conversation about nitrogen limits. The talk should have started 20 years ago. Now it's begun with a fight, he says, about EPA data and about how Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Vermont residents will have to foot the bill to clean up Long Island Sound. For New England Public Radio, I'm Jill Kaufman.
Okay, he was not a real doctor. His friends and family called him Ted. Since his death in 1991, Theodore Seuss Geisel has become the best-selling author of children's books in the world. Now the city of Springfield, Massachusetts, is paying homage to its favorite native son with the first-of-a-kind Seuss Museum. New England Public Radio's Charlene Scott reports.
A few weeks before the museum's opening, construction workers and painters put finishing touches on the space. The walls blaze with a riot of colors, including reds, blues, greens, and orange. Large murals show favorite characters. Horton the elephant studies the Who sitting on his trunk. The Cat in the Hat balances a number of objects on his paws and tail. And rushing down the stairs with a plate of green eggs and ham is Sam I Am. Remember him?
That's Sam I Am. That's Sam I Am. I do not like that Sam I Am. Do you like green eggs and ham? I do not like them, Sam I Am. I do not like green eggs and ham.
The entire first floor of the new museum offers interactive displays. In the recreation of Seuss's boyhood bedroom in Springfield, children can draw on touch screens, mimicking artwork done on the walls by the young Seuss and his sister Marnie.
And then his relationship with his mother with the bakery, which is downtown here.
Artist and designer John Simpson.
And then with his father fishing at McGilligan's pool. We tried to show how these little family experiences contributed to his imagination.
Family experiences are also highlighted on the second floor, where Seuss's two stepdaughters have installed their own personal collections, gathered while they lived with their mother and their stepdad in La Jolla, California. Lee Gray Diamond says she just about emptied out her own house in order to recreate the rooms where Seuss spent most of his time.
This is his chair. He would lean back in the chair, always with his feet up, and he would look at what he was doing. The room is lined with bulletin boards, and he would pace out the book on pale yellow paper, and he would work the room over and over, and then he'd kick back in his chair with his feet up, and then he would throw the chair forward, his hair would come forward, and he'd be working at the desk.
At the end of every workday, Lee Gray says her stepdad would have a gin and tonic, complete with a kumquat snatched from the yard. Dinner took place on the sofa, where the whole family would use trays on their laps. That sofa now sits in the recreation of the Seuss sitting room, along with family tapestries and other furnishings. Lee Gray and her sister have also contributed drawings, photographs, and other family memorabilia that have never been seen by the public before.
You saw him at his desk making these things. He would drop little notes on your bed or put them in your coat pocket. So everybody has memories of their pop and their mom. Those are your memories if Ted was your step-pop.
Lee Gray's famous step-pop almost didn't make it as a children's book author. Some 27 publishers rejected his first effort, and To Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street, before it finally appeared in print in 1937. 20 years later, Seuss joined a campaign to improve children's literacy by writing a book using only a few hundred simple words.
We looked. Then we saw him step in on the mat. We looked, and we saw him. The Cat in the Hat. And he said to us, "Why do you sit there like that? I know it is wet."
The Cat in the Hat helped launch a beginner book series that's still helping kids learn to read today. Eventually, versions of Seuss's books would appear on television, in feature films, and on Broadway. That led to recognition from the Oscars, the Emmys, the Grammys, a Pulitzer Prize, and a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Before all that success, Ted Geisel worked as an illustrator and cartoonist. During World War II, he drew some anti-Japanese cartoons. These are not currently on display or mentioned at all in the museum. Lee Gray Diamond says her stepfather eventually came to regret his feelings about the Japanese.
Of course he evolved and changed, and I'm very careful not to put words in his mouth, but the man I knew did not have any type of racism or prejudice. We never heard any type of talk, ever.
But Lee Gray says the family did hear his opinions about social and political issues, which he often included in his books. Seuss wrote Yertle the Turtle as an allegory about Hitler. The Lorax focuses on the environment.
Mister,
he said with a sawdusty sneeze,
I am the Lorax. I speak for the trees. I speak for the trees have no tongues. And I'm asking you, sir, at the top of my lungs.
He was very upset.
Kids can read about the Lorax and some of Dr. Seuss's other famous characters in a museum exhibition space called Readingville, while their parents explore the recreated rooms on the second floor where Seuss lived and worked. Lee Gray Diamond says her stepfather would have loved this museum.
He would be absolutely at ease here. And to know that he's going to be here permanently, safe, protected, that people who want to know more are going to make the trip here to see him, it's perfect.
For New England Public Radio, I'm Charlene Scott.
And I'd like to follow that up with a clip from The Shortlist, which is our weekly reporter roundtable. One of the guests was Rick Hurst. He's the publisher of the newspaper African American Point of View. And he had a very different take on Dr. Seuss than we heard in that story. So I'm going to play this clip now.
And to be honest with you, Dr. Seuss has not been one of the favorite lines of reading for minorities, not for black folks in Springfield, not when I was coming up, not for my kids. And when I talk to folks, and I have talked to folks about this museum, open it up, and they're not very enthusiastic about it. Because of the racial aspect, exactly what you were saying. Folks are not comfortable that they are welcome in those kind of situations. And I have not been enthusiastic myself. I hear all the hoopla and I say to myself, is that all there is?
That was Rick Hurst. He's a regular panelist on The Shortlist, NEPR's Week in Review. You can catch that Fridays at 5:50 on New England Public Radio. Next up, we have a commentary. In President Trump's proposed budget, he eliminates federal support for public libraries throughout the country. The White House has said these cuts and others are all about fiscal responsibility and an effort to, quote, redefine the proper role of the federal government. But the move has got commentator Aaron Valentino thinking about the crucially important places libraries take us.
Libraries, they're just always there, in your town or at your school, part of the scene. We take them for granted about as much as we do the roads where we live. But where would we be without them? I'm a librarian at a college, so anything I say might seem to smack of self-interest. But my devotion to them way predates my working life. I grew up in farm country back when kids roamed barefoot and free in the humid summer. Byard Taylor Library was a favorite destination. Full disclosure, the library was air-conditioned. It was a place for me and my sister and my cousins to escape to, dirty feet, sweat and all, and to escape in. There, in the cool and quiet, we could make our own choices, what to read, what to explore, imagine, and dream. My now-grown sister observes, libraries are experiments in trust. You borrow books, delight in them, treat them well, return them. She says they reflect people's inherent goodness. My North Star is wherever the library is. I'm uplifted by the mere sight of one, like my local one with its Carnegie-era charm. My family's love of libraries isn't unique. You should hear the stories I get when I tell people I'm a librarian. Everywhere I go, everyone has at least one they really want to tell me. Public libraries are all about connection, not just of people to information, but of people to each other. One way they do it is by creating programs tied into local culture. These days, I live in rural Connecticut, and a major hit at my tiny library is when the chicken man comes to discuss best practices for raising chickens. But another way libraries connect us is by offering classes like English for non-English speakers and how to use apps on your phone, or by delivering books to homebound people. There's nothing that replaces what libraries do. Benevolent social connection, access for everybody to all sorts of information, a haven for dreamers. Without libraries, we are lost.
Erin Valentino lives in Coventry, Connecticut. She works as a librarian in Hartford. For birds, this time of year, it's all about singing. But as New England Public Radio's Nancy Cullen reports, some birds have a different take on song. Rather than singers, they are percussionists.
Every spring, like clockwork, I wake up to something like this. It's a woodpecker tapping a tree with its beak. Sounds to me like a big bird, but every time I gaze up, I can't find it.
You stretch the bird out, it's 5, at most 6 inches.
That's ornithologist Don Krudsma, a retired UMass professor. He says this is probably a downy woodpecker, the smallest around here, but he and other experts say it could also be the hairy, which sounds similar. Both are black and white with a distinctive white patch on the back. Unlike songbirds, which use vibrating membranes, kind of like vocal cords to sing, woodpeckers pound their beaks. It's called drumming. Woodpeckers also use their beaks to search for food, insects, or to make a hole for a nest. Most songbirds learn their species' song by imitating adults. Each woodpecker species has its own drum, and it's believed woodpeckers just know how to do it. It's innate.
They pick a certain spot on a dead branch on a tree right at the base, and they can find that resonant spot where the sound just booms and radiates out.
In late winter, males drum to claim a territory. Both males and females can drum to attract a mate or to tell each other their location. Krudsma describes a woodpecker working a tree.
He finds a sweet spot, and it's a magnificent drum. He moves over just a little bit. He hits a soft spot. Doesn't sound quite right. And he moves back to the strong spot. So they know what they're listening for, I'm quite sure.
Some species of woodpeckers drum on gutters and other found objects.
My favorite ever was a flicker who was drumming on a wooden fence post with the fence wire going through a metal staple. And every time he drummed on the wooden post, there was this beautiful ringing sound of the metal wire through the metal staple. They are tool-using woodpeckers, truly.
Krudsma recorded 2 hairy woodpeckers several years ago at the Quabbin Reservoir in a kind of call and response. Krudsma believes these are 2 males because they were far apart, as if on neighboring territories. Woodpeckers drumming can be heard until about the end of June. For New England Public Radio, I'm Nancy Cohen.
All right, that's all we got. This podcast is produced by New England Public Radio, the same listener-supported public media company that pumps news and music to your car, your home, and your phone 24/7, 365. You can support it all at NEPR.net. Just click the bright orange donate button at the top of the page. Thanks for listening to NEPR News Now, stories you really should not miss. Until next time.